Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And welcome to the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. Gary Trust, Billboard's co-director of charts.
And hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
Part two this week of our 1987 countdown. So last week we did numbers 40 through number 21 for August 29th, 1987. So we're picking up this week with the top half of the countdown. If this were a TV show, Trevor, we should have done last week at the end of the show. To be continued. That was a big thing in the 80s.
Nobody would have seen it, though, because it was always the screen fades to black, and then they kind of have, you know, bring up the little text and the dots. So, I mean, there's no sound. No one says to be continued.
I guess
so
we should have said it.
It's I don't know if it would have had the same effect. But high five and congratulations to you if you got through last week. So it was a bit of a marathon there. You probably actually, if you were, maybe not a marathon, but if you're a really talented runner, you probably could have run about two-thirds of a marathon in that time.
Yeah, it was about an hour and 36 minutes, I think.
1:36. That's great time. Also, shout out if you also paid attention last week. We also had a nice interview with our friend Tiffany,
right,
who was making her debut on the chart for August 29th at number 84, the song I Think We're Alone Now. And now I know many kids who are in the 80s now have that song stuck in their head.
Have you guys talked since the interview? There was a connection there.
I mean, Tiff, if you're out there, you know, Hit a bro up.
She's married, but you guys had a connection.
I mean,
you're a homewrecker, Trevor.
music history, unfortunately, is full of homewreckers. I guess I pinned myself to that list.
All right. So last week in the top 40, a lot of classic artists, a lot of classic hits. We heard The Heart, Prince, Gloria Estefan, Bob Seger, Steve Winwood, Sammy Hagar, Bananarama. That was just 40 through 21. So we're going to go 20 to 1 this week. Plenty more stars from the 80s, having some huge hits, having some deeper cuts that maybe you don't remember as well, some of their biggest hits at this point. So we're going to go 20 to 1. And this week, as we said last time, we had Tiffany on last week. Got to have Debbie Gibson on this week. So she was making her chart debut 30 years ago as well. Her debut album, Out of the Blue, was just coming out around this time. It was about to make its chart debut. And Debbie Gibson is coming up here on the countdown. So let's kick into this week. 1987, August 29th is the date of the Hot 100. We'll go 20 to 1. This is number 20.
Yeah.
Numbers 20 through 16 this week on the Billboard Hot 100, August 29th, 1987. We are kicked off at number 20, cover of a classic. It was Wipeout by the Fat Boys and the Beach Boys. So originally...
All the boys.
Number two hit originally back in 1963 for the Surfaris, and that was the time when the Beach Boys were breaking through, so it made sense to bring them on to this song. We'd go on to hit number 12, and then the Fat Boys realized they were onto something. In 1988, they remade... The Twist with Chubby Checker. He wasn't officially credited on the song, but it was a top 20 hit as well on the Hot 100 a year later. Their cover of the all-time Hot 100 number one, The Twist.
You know, that. I mean, I guess nowadays they always say that everything comes around in 20s, so I mean, I guess the logic is still true back then. 1987, cover things from the 60s, get that wave of nostalgia going, and there you go.
Right, like how we're getting covers now of stuff from the 90s. Like Camila Cabello remaking Fastballs Out of My Head was about 20 years earlier. So yeah. Same kind of deal.
We had a whole album from Taylor based on 1989 sounds.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
And here's my favorite stat about the Fat Boys. It's not a chart stat. Their combined weight, the Fat Boys, is a trio, about 750 pounds.
How did you access people's medical records? Or?
No, I read that.
So 750 into 3 is about 250 apiece.
Yeah. Number 19 this week, hitting the top 20 this week, up for number 25. I think one of the most interesting songs really in Hot 100 history, I don't think that's an exaggeration, Touch of Grey by the Grateful Dead. So here's the deal with Grateful Dead at this point. Now, 2017, legendary act, everybody knows about them. People knew about them then, but to that point, they had had 5 Hot 100 hits. Between 1970 and 1980, hadn't been on the chart since then, and had never gone higher than number 64. And then they come along with this song, Touch of Grey, obviously much more catchy, more mainstream, more poppy than pretty much anything they'd ever recorded at that point. Would go on to a number 9 peak in September, so it became their first top 40 hit after being on the chart for so long. And the album was from In the Dark. Would go on to hit number 6 on the Billboard 200. Similarly, their first top 10 on the Billboard 200 with their 23rd entry about 20 years into their chart career. So that would be like now, an act that's been around for about 20 years, you know, big, but had never had any kind of hit single, suddenly having a hit like that. Maybe I'm thinking sort of like how Daft Punk a few years ago with Get Lucky broke through with a hit single, kind of like that, I guess. You know, they're still going so strong now. Obviously, we lost Jerry Garcia, but in May 2017, they just celebrated 50 years on the Billboard 200. They've had 83 charted titles as we're taping this. Just debuted a couple weeks ago at number 30 with their latest compilation. You know, they've had 5 top 40 albums this year alone on the Billboard 200, The Grateful Dead, here in 2017.
Like they've been in the top 40 this year?
Yeah, with 5 different titles.
Is a lot of it like legacies?
It's all these Dave picks. It's these Dave picks compilations. So they keep re-releasing old shows, and they sell really well. The fans want to have all these copies.
Definitely Deadheads love the concert and the live atmosphere of it. So that makes sense why people would want to grab those up.
And the latest one on the August 19th chart, it was the 4th best-selling album of the week across all genres. I think the other thing, too, when you look at this overall, so this was their only top 10 Hot 100 hit, their only top 40 hit. So I was looking at what other acts have had one top 10 on the Hot 100 and no other top 40 hits who are also legendary. So obviously...
Ooh, not the editorial discretion about legendary.
Well, it's kind of editorial, but obviously a lot of people have had one top 10 and no other top 40 hits, just one hit wonders, mm-hmm. and that's their only hit. But who's done that and is an absolute household name? I came up with two who I think fit that. I'll run the test by you.
Okay.
I think the best example, the best-selling album artist in Nielsen history.
Interesting. I want to look at that case. That's an interesting case. So I'll go ahead and let everybody know that the answer to that riddle is the one and only Garth Brooks. He was on the forefront of that country explosion in the 90s. And
yeah, 70,
sold a ton of albums.
71.9 million albums sold in the U.S. since Nielsen data began in 1991. He's had one top 40 hit, one top 10 hit on the Hot 100. It's such a lost, no pun intended, song in his catalog, Lost in You, number 5, 1999. And it was Garth Brooks
as Chris Gaines.
Yeah. So it's not The Dance. It's not Thunder Rolls. It's not Friends in Low Places. One top 40 hit on the Hot 100, and it's a top 10 hit, just like Grateful Dead. One other one, going back to the early 70s, Me and Bobby McGee, number one hit, 1971, her only top 40 hit. And everyone knows who Janis Joplin is.
Interesting. I mean, I guess not to undersell. I mean, that was a little bit after she had passed away in 1970. So that kind of probably with the Pearl album kind of swept some of that up. Maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but the common thread among all these three acts,
still a great song though.
Right. But Grateful Dead, Garth Brooks, and Janis Joplin, all not core pop acts. So they've completely found their following, found their audiences, and just, you know, for these different circumstances, wound up having one song that crossed over. So it's not like they were core pop acts. They had their success, just made these inroads once in a while at pop. All right, let's move on. Number 18 here on the Hot 100, 1987. Down from the top 10, it had gotten to number 4, British band T'Pau with Heart and Soul. And I know basically nothing about Star Trek, but T'Pau is named after a Vulcan princess.
I don't know anything about Star Trek either, so
we'll move on. Number 17, interesting title and artist because they're the same thing. At number 17, Living in a Box by Living in a Box this week, 30 years ago. So in that,
you've heard about self-titled albums, right? But talk about a self-titled single. That's bold.
It's not the only song ever to double up as a title and artist, Voices That Care, in 1991, actually went to number 11. But yeah, there have been acts that have put their names into MC Hammer, Here Comes the Hammer, My Name is Prince, The Old Alabama. Last year we had Roses by Chainsmokers featuring Roses. Yeah. We just had Kill Jay-Z by Jay-Z. Yeah. So it happens every once in a while. But this was pure same title and artist. And they have a greatest hits. It's called The Best of Living in a Box. The missed opportunity, they do not have a greatest hits called The Living in a Box Set.
I knew Box Set was going to have to
Living yeah. in a Box Set.
Maybe they don't have you know, quite enough to make it a whole set.
I'm kind of willing it into existence.
I see. We'll look out for that on Amazon coming near you.
Number 16, wrapping up the first five songs here in the top 20 this week, 1987, and goes back to a song we heard back, if you're listening last week, at number 29 was One Heartbeat by Smokey Robinson, and at number 16 was a descriptive song about that, When Smokey Sings by ABC. And they would actually go on to be in the top 10 together in October. So One Heartbeat was on the rise. So was When Smokey Sings this week. And they'd both be in the top 10 for a week in October. Paul Grine, who created the Chartbeat column in Billboard, he confirmed it. He said it was the first time that a song about an artist has appeared in the top 10 at the same time as a song by that artist. So history was about to be made.
I say, look at Smokey. You know, this is over 20 years, like we said, since he came to prominence through his tenure at Motown and with the Miracles. And I mean, I wonder how it makes him. I mean, I'm sure. I guess if you ask him how it makes him feel, he'd probably say what a lot of celebrities say when you ask him. It makes me feel old. But how great, you know, that there's a group out there that wants to pay tribute to you. The same way we'll see, you know, down the line with a lot of acts, Tim McGraw, obviously, and Taylor Swift. And plenty of others.
How'd you feel if there was a podcast called When Trevor Talks? Wouldn't you feel good about that?
I would be scared before that first click. I'd be like, oh, they're probably going to roast the hell out of me. Like, when Trevor talks, I just want to, you know, just throw my computer out the window.
And that was actually ABC's last hit on the Hot 100, but it was their highest charting. We'd go on to hit number 5. They had some great songs in the mid-80s, like kind of a new wave pop, soulful kind of crossover. The Look of Love was a hit. And they had one top 10 before when Smokey Sings, Be Near Me, had gotten to number 9. So good catalog for ABC. All right, let's keep going. We're up to number 15 now on the Billboard Hot 100 this week, 1987.
She's as fine as she can be. All right, let's pick it up back at number 15 this week on the Hot 100, August 29th, 1987. Number 15, we've got Here I Go Again by Whitesnake. Not an 80s countdown if you do not have an 80s power ballad. So Whitesnake filling that bill for us to kick us off here. Here I Go Again, which most people may not realize this, obviously a smash hit in 1987. It's climbing up the chart. Eventually, it will land at number one later in the fall. This song was actually originally recorded in 1982 on the group's album, but was redone in 87 for their self-titled album. So it's one of those kind of cases where, and there's a few others in music history where, you know, the first time, for whatever reason, it's not picked as a single, doesn't quite work out the same way, and, you know, when the moment and the timing is right, and, you know, timing a lot of times can be everything in music, it gets you a number one hit.
About the same time, we heard Steve Winwood back at number 22, but he'd then have he had Valerie. Same deal. He had recorded an earlier version of that. It wasn't really a big hit. Gave it a little more polish, a little more late 80s production. That went on to become a top 10 hit, also in 1987. So another example right there.
There you go. All right, number 14. We got, Huey Lewis and the News, Doing It All for My Baby. Now, one of the things that I think people may not actually remember about this song is its music video. Actually, kind of quirky. It's about almost 8 minutes long.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was kind of one of those things almost reserved only for Michael Jackson at that time. I mean, to go and do that full movie. It has this weird mad scientist vibe to it in this graveyard. It's kind of cheesy nowadays. It holds up, but Huey Lewis and the News really coming off their huge run of hits in the 1980s. They had scored their third number one hit just earlier that year with Jacob's Ladder. Their third of three number one hits that they'd all had between 1985 and 1987. This song, Doing It All for My Baby, ends up being a number six hit on the Hot 100. And they'll actually have one more top 10 right after that. The song Perfect World will get to number three. And that will be the last time Huey Lewis in the News, at least this far, has hit the top 10. This song kind of, you know, it's a fun little, it's got a little throwback sound to it.
Yeah, a little doo-wop.
Yeah,
some of the harmonies. Oh, yeah.
The Four Seasons kind of element.
That was a big part of their sound back then. Anything almost they put out in the 80s became such a big hit. You know, music changed a little bit, went a little harder in the 90s, and, you know, they weren't able to keep that string of success going. But so many classics, not just The Power of Love. So The Perfect World you just mentioned, it's probably my favorite song of theirs.
Oh, yeah. All right, we'll keep on climbing to number 13 this week, back in 1987. We had seen on last week's countdown two songs from the film soundtrack to Beverly Hills Cop 2, and we finally bring up the third and final piece on this week's chart. That's going to be George Michael's I Want Your Sex.
That was a pretty risque title at the time, and it was a big deal to say that on radio back then. So you saying it now, 30 years later, it's a little more acceptable now.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a lot worse that's come across the airwaves in that time. But yeah, so George Michael, I Want Your Sex, like Gary said, a pretty straightforward kind of song out there. This single also a big moment in George's solo career. He'd obviously been one half of the duo Wham, and really the front man of that group, had gone solo. And around this time, he put out one song already, number one hit earlier in the year. He'd had Aretha Franklin, the duet,
right.
I Knew You Were Waiting For Me. But interesting song because, you know, it's, and when you listen to it now, it's so 80s. It's kind of weird how
it's got that 80s
how
production.
Overt it is, right. In a way, without, you know, it's not creepy, but you're like, this is almost, you know, if this had been anybody else, it really could have been like a novelty song. That's just like, okay, right. Like, that's just, you know, that's the song that you put out, whatever.
From a 1987 to today, and it's that same deal. He had been in a poppy group, a duo, before then. And whenever these acts want to make that break to being solo, they so often do it with this song that so literally announces, I'm an adult artist. Zane Pillow Talk, yeah. Really not that different from George Michael, what he did.
That's a fair point. That, yes, I am a man now. I've grown up, yeah.
So the musical version of a bar mitzvah. Because we're in 1987 when I had mine. That's how artists announced that they were becoming a man at that point.
There we go. I Want Your Sex, parentheses, George's Bar Mitzvah. All right, we'll leave George behind at number 13. We'll keep on climbing at number 12. This week in 1987, we got Dionne Warwick and Jeffrey Osborne, a duet called Love Power, written and produced by one of the big adult contemporary teams of that era, Burt Bacharach and Carol Bayer Sager. I mean, Dionne Warwick at this time, we'll focus on her first. You know, Dionne had been around for as we've seen with a lot of these acts really on this countdown, Beach Boys, Smokey Robinson, others. Dionne had had a, you know, two-decade-plus career at this point. And it's interesting because there are actually a lot of sort of vocalists from the R&B scene who are in that same kind of mold at this point in the 80s. We mentioned with George Michael just a few moments ago, his duet with Aretha Franklin. You know, so she had a number one hit earlier that year.
Right.
Also in the 80s, you know, we've got another duet between Patti LaBelle, Michael McDonald, On My Own, which was also another number one hit just a few years back. So, interesting, Dionne also fitting into that mold of these duets that, you know, really, really extend the life of the career.
Right. And kept all these veteran acts going, like we said last week. It was a good time for veteran acts, especially right here around 1987 with Smokey Robinson. We heard Grateful Dead. It was just a time when they were putting out good music and it was still accepted. It feels like somewhere in the 90s, I think pop culture as a whole just got a little slicker. You know, videos had become much more entrenched and just became more about youth, but in 87, yeah. it was still cool. Still cool to be experienced.
People found out that kids had money. You know, that changed the game.
Nothing on Jeffrey Osborne?
Nah, bro.
I can help you here. He was he's from Providence, Rhode Island. I worked on radio in Providence. We played Stay With Me Tonight a lot on the radio. It was a big, big Providence hit. Even it was a hit in the 80s, but even into the 90s when I was there, still got a lot of requests. Still always came up in rotation.
Oh, yeah.
Shout out to Providence.
Shout out to Providence. But for now, we're going to keep on climbing to number 11. And we're going to talk about, this is actually great. They're on the chart this week. One of the big acts of 1987, who we can't go without mentioning, U2. Number 11 that week on the Hot 100, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. So the song had been number one for 2 weeks. At this point, it's sliding back down and has just come out of the top 10. You know, 1987, I mean, you think of course, With or Without You, which had been the single before this, hitting number one, the Joshua Tree album really just, you know, opening the door for U2 in a way that it hadn't before. They'd hit the top 40 previously before these two number one hits with Pride in the Name of Love, which had got number 33. But like I said, with Joshua Tree, I mean, still today holds up as one of the most critically acclaimed albums of all time.
Right.
Wins the Grammy for Album of the Year.
And we've heard a lot this year of the 30th anniversary of the Joshua Tree.
Yeah. So I mean, they're on tour, you know, performing the whole album. A lot, some legacy kind of reissuings going on. So definitely holds up as one of the classics, not only of the 80s, but really of all time. All right, guys, we're up into the top 10 at this point. So 10 more songs to go. Numbers 10 through 6, we'll check those out right now. Let's give them a go.
Touching you, I feel it all again. Didn't we all
All right, number 10, we're going to shove right over to Gary because I know he is a huge fan of that song. That's Can't We Try, Dan Hill, a duet with Vonda Shepherd. So Dan Hill is one of those guys, again, that most people may not realize they know a song by him,
right.
But they certainly do.
This is about a decade after his first hit, similar
sometimes,
song.
Sometimes When We Touch.
Right.
Like literally that one.
Yeah.
You know, the honesty is too much.
Right.
And everyone knows like those four lines from that hook, and then maybe they don't know the rest of the song. But even to have like that kind of like sort of one of those iconic hooks, I mean that's got to be something.
Yeah, and Can't We Try is such a catchy song too. Maybe in the shadow a little bit of Sometimes When We Touch, but huge hit in '87. Really fit that that those male pop singer songwriters who were so big at this time on the charts. Big AC artists in the '80s and '90s. Going back to the '70s.
Cool thing to note also, yeah, of course, for Vonda Shepherd, that even though she'd had a top 10 song, you know, in her career, probably certainly best known as the singer at the bar from a couple seasons of Ally McBeal.
Right.
Definitely things still coming for her. All right, we'll keep on moving up to number 9. We've got Starship, It's Not Over Till It's Over. This song is the 8th top 10 hit that Starship is going to have, and will be their last trip to the top 10. This even actually also dates back to their days as Jefferson Airplane. You know, kind of one of those songs that, and maybe people will see as kind of appropriate, you know, as the 80s kind of start to end. And as you mentioned a couple times, some new sounds, whether it's, you know, new sounds in R&B, new jack swing are going to come start moving into the mainstream.
Grunge for rock.
Yeah, exactly. Country's going to pick up as well, right, around the corner. So one of the last heydays for one of the rock acts that has been really consistent for the 70s and 80s there.
And if you look at the small print on the Hot 100 this week, 1987, you see one of the writers, that's Phil Galston, who was on the podcast earlier this year. He oversees the songwriting program at NYU. So look at that. He's in the top 10 this week, 30 years ago.
Save the best for last.
Right.
Which, what do you think? Are those? Can you see the same guy having a hand in those two songs?
He went for the hooks when he would write some of these songs in the 80s and 90s, and two catchy songs.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Okay.
That's a yes. And look who we're up to now, Trevor, at number 8.
Yeah, I was going to say, as we turn the page from some of those acts who were big in the 70s and 80s, we're going to look at somebody who was going to be big in the 80s and huge in the 90s.
I think I can leave here. This is going to be the Trevor monologue to his idol, Whitney Houston.
All right. Number 8 is Whitney Houston, Didn't We Almost Have It All? So the second single from the Whitney album, which earlier that summer became the first album by any woman to ever debut at number 1 on the Billboard 200. So that, you know, already in a way tells you how big Whitney was in 1987, how much expectation there was for the second album, anticipation really as well. Had a number 1 hit earlier that summer as well with I Want to Dance with Somebody Who Loves Me, which actually this week on August 29th is sliding back down the charts, but it's still there at number 52. So now the second single taking its place. You know, one of those songs, I mean, it's obviously the big ballad, you know, they kind of played both sides. I Want to Dance with Somebody, a little more fun up-tempo for the summer, but then remind people, of course, of Whitney's vocals.
Right.
You know, in terms of, what do you think, in terms of the Whitney ballads, where do you put this song?
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, I mean, it. I don't know if it really gets its due, and Gary, that's so tough.
Personally, I'd probably put I Have Nothing as my favorite Whitney ballad if I had to rank
it. Okay.
And or One Moment in Time. For some reason, those are the two that I like the best.
Okay. I mean, really, there is no not solid choice. So those are all good choices. I mean, I think it's one of those songs that people really appreciate the vocal performance. You know, I mean, 1987 Whitney, it's very hard to top that song, just the ability. But I don't know if it, you know, really gets the same kind of love, you know, in terms of the culture, whether it's on, you know, talent shows that people audition for or songs that people really even know.
Right.
I wouldn't think most people would even maybe know the words to the song. I mean, it is a little long. It clocks in, you know, at over 5 minutes on the album version.
It really shows off her vocals, though. She holds a lot of notes. It's a total powerhouse vocal.
I mean, especially, like around the second chorus, some of the bridge. I mean, those are some high, high sustained notes. If you haven't heard it, you know, check it out. And this is the part we're talking about. When I mention that bridge part, this is what I mean.
Right.
that part.
Got its own.
You see what I'm saying?
Got its own piece of the countdown here. Two clips of that song.
It had to. I mean, those are vocals that you just can't describe. You just have to, you know, a voice is worth a thousand words, I guess. But also to wrap this up into Whitney's chart career at this time, we mentioned with George Michael a little while ago about four number one hits from the same album. This album that Whitney's currently in the cycle for is going to do that as well. Like we said, I Want to Dance with Somebody was already number one. Didn't We Almost Have It All? It's on its way to number one. And then the next two singles, So Emotional and Where Do Broken Hearts Go, will also hit number one in 1988. Also, fun fact, Gary, I think chart nerds probably know this. Tie those four number one hits to the three number ones that Whitney had from her previous album, Saving All My Love for You, How Will I Know, Greatest Love of All. That gives her seven in a row on the Hot 100, which is a record, breaks the record that the Beatles and the Bee Gees had. And remind me who's done that since?
You just want me to come out and say nobody's done it since?
Nobody. Nobody's been able to string together seven number ones in a row on the Hot 100 ever since then.
Yeah. And the song that broke Whitney's streak, do you remember?
This is actually kind of throwing it back as well, because as we talked about on last week's countdown, there was a song by Jelly Bean, and Jelly Bean actually does produce the song that breaks Whitney's streak, which is a song called Love Will Save the Day. It was another top 10 hit, peaked to number 9 later in 1988.
A little more experimental. It's easy to see why that didn't hit. It wasn't based so much on a hook. It was kind of more of a club song. So it was kind of like a bonus single to begin with. Anything else to say about Whitney for now, Trevor?
I think we're gonna leave Whitney for a little bit. One fun thing we'll note, kind of tying together Whitney number 8 and number 7, the masterminds of Whitney's next album after all this Whitney era, you know, Where Do Broken Hearts Go, Love Will Save the Day, So Emotional is over. 3 years from now, she'll be working with the production team behind the hit that is number 7. This week in 1987, the song is, that's a lot of sevens, Rocksteady by The Whispers, produced by L.A. Reid and Babyface. So this is actually the chart debut of those two. Yeah. I mean, they'll go on to be titans, of course, for the rest of the 80s and certainly into the 90s.
That's a song you still hear now. 30 years later, Rocksteady, that still plays on adult contemporary radio. Really? Oh, yeah. The stations I listen to, yes.
I listen to them old stations, I guess. But if anything, you know, the Whispers can definitely claim that, you know, they helped put L.A. and Babyface on the map.
Right.
And with the Whispers at number 7, that's going to become a very familiar place for L.A. Reid and Babyface throughout the next decade. You know, the dynamic duo is going to go on. Babyface alone, as a producer, going to have more than 40 top 10 hits to his credit. And L.A. Reid going to have more than 20. And, of course, L.A. Reid transitions into a successful businessman, running a few record labels into the 2000s, 2010s. So really, you know, this is one of the starts that I'm sure in 1987, you know, nobody would have seen coming. But this is a big week for those guys. You know, this is the start of a new era.
That's what's fun about these countdowns, too. We look back. It's, you know, the chart was frozen in time when it happened. But now we can see who went on to have a different sides of their career years later. It's a great example of what they'd go on to do.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of somebody who is already having a huge career at the time and will go on to even more iconic heights. Right there at number 6, the icon of the decade, Syeda Garrett, teaming up with Michael Jackson, who is the birthday boy. August 29th, 1987.
That's right.
It's Michael Jackson's 29th birthday. So glad we're talking about him. And at number 6, I Just Can't Stop Loving You, the first single from the Bad album, climbing up the charts. It had been number 10 the week before and climbing on its way to number 1.
You know, we're in the midst of all these albums we're looking back of that had so many hits. George Michael, four number ones from Faith, Whitney Houston. We were just talking about all these hits. Mm-hmm. This is the first single of 7 from Bad. So an era where albums really went deep in singles, and kind of interesting, I suppose, looking back at the hits from Bad, that this was the first single. A number one hit it would go on to be, but I think if you think of the Bad singles now, you don't necessarily think of this song at least first, or maybe remember that it was the first single given what came after it.
And part of that, too, probably lending to the fact there's a music video for the song. So, you know, doesn't quite have that same familiarity that people would with, you know, I mean, the Billie Jeans, the Way You Make Me Feel, even, or Dirty Diana or whatnot.
You didn't mention Man in the Mirror. I feel like that's probably the most iconic song from Bad years later.
Really? I guess my dad just, like, hated that song growing up, that we never really listened to it. So I always think of, you know, bad and the dancier cuts as the ones.
That's not a
smooth
biased
criminal.
That's not a biased opinion.
I'm just it's just
it's who you are.
It's just who I am. Yeah. But yeah, so at this time, Michael Jackson, the Bad album is coming out in just a few days on the 31st of August. So you can already imagine that the fever is record high for it. Interestingly enough, we'll talk about Syeda Garrett, who at this time, a songwriter. She actually will have a hand in co-writing Man in the Mirror.
Right.
For the album. But this is something I find still to this day kind of almost hard to believe. So the song, obviously a duet between a man and a woman, Michael Jackson wrote. He asked several women to duet with him on this song. And in 1987, they all turned him down. And do you have any ideas about who were some of the people he asked?
Was Whitney Houston one of them?
Whitney was one.
Yeah, all right.
I guess Clive said, you know, we're too busy with our own album, can't do it. Who knows? Aretha Franklin, another one that he'd asked for, and Barbra Streisand, among others. Yeah,
I could hear her doing that song,
and
that's kind of in her style.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, because it's, you know, it's a soft, you know,
very lush,
tender, yeah ballad. Right. Yeah. But in any case, I mean, you think that, you know, we look back now, you know, if Michael Jackson asked you to do anything in 1987, you would have moved heaven and earth because you knew it was going to be a smash hit. I mean, which this ended up being, but just kind of crazy that, you know, for that. They all rejected him. And it turns out that Syeda Garrett, of course, gets lucky. I mean, she grabs another number one hit. She says the story is, you know, Quincy Jones, who's producing the song, you know, Michael just came in to record one day, and he was talking with Syeda, and they were just, you know, kind of talking, and he just told her, you know, get in there. You're going to sing it with him. And she was like, as we all probably been, like, you know, shocked, paralyzed.
Right.
What? Okay. Well, I guess I'm doing a duet with Michael Jackson. And, as we said, of course, the song will eventually climb to number one. One thing I have to note, as a Whitney Houston fan, the song will be replaced at number one by Didn't We Almost Have It All, which we saw is two spots behind at number eight.
I thought we were done talking about Whitney.
No, we're not. No, never done. So had Whitney recorded the song, she could have knocked herself out of number one.
Oh, right.
And would have been potentially the first woman to do it.
Which didn't happen until Taylor Swift.
Exactly. I mean, she would have had that record, you know, quarter century before it actually happened. So just lamenting as a Whitney fan. And of course, that would have been another number one for her. But oh, well. Oh, all right. Can't have it all, right?
All right. From your fanboying to mine now. We're up to number five, the Billboard Hot 100 this week. 1987, Debbie Gibson is in this week. 30 years ago, she's up from number seven to number five with her debut hit, Only in My Dreams, her first top five hit on the Billboard Hot 100 this week. 30 years ago, so here to talk about it is Debbie Gibson herself. We've also got joining us in just a second here for the interview is Alex Vitulis, also of the charts department, as we'll find out, collector of Debbie Gibson memorabilia back in the 80s. She had a lot of stuff out back then, pins to put on jackets.
Were you a proud Deb head back in the day?
I was. I saw her in concert in 1989. I don't think I had all the collectible stuff.
You didn't have like the Debbie Trapper Keeper or anything?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, she'll say in the interview how when she's got a new box set coming out, how she'll say how she's getting some of the memorabilia to recap for her career. It's from fans. So she'll talk about that coming up. Talk about sort of like how we talked with Tiffany last week. Debbie was about to turn 17. She was 16 at the time in 1987. Talking about starting a career at that point. At that age, most people are in high school, as she was. Maybe you're getting your first job after school somewhere. She was launching her career with on Atlantic Records. So she talks about that coming up and 30 years in the business and perspective, kind of like Tiffany did last week, how she can look back now and know certain lessons she didn't know then, and really just insights from someone who's been there for 30 years.
So without further ado, let's bring in Debbie Gibson here on the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we're actually taping this ahead of time, but this podcast is posting on August 31st. I don't know if you knew that, Debbie. So happy arrival day.
Nice. Thank
yes,
you.
Happy arrival day.
Happy arrival day, yeah. Debbie.
Love it.
You're going to have to sing happy arrival day. We'll have to rework it. All right. So thank you so much, Debbie, for coming back on the podcast. And we're talking this time about Out of the Blue, your debut album, OOTB30, 30th anniversary, debuted on the Billboard 200 chart on September 5th, 1987, the week before Only in My Dreams became your first top five Hot 100 hit. How does it hit you now to hear a 30-year anniversary of the album?
It's pretty wild because I definitely don't feel like an old person. And I don't consider my fans to be old people. That just sounds like a lot of time, you know? But it's really wild when I think about how much has changed in the industry over that time. And I mean, it's just like this journey, this musical journey that I've taken with my audience, that we've taken together, you know, we've seen and been through a lot together since that little album kind of burst out of nowhere that we did in 6 weeks. I don't know if I ever told you that whole album was done in 6 weeks time.
Well, I was going to ask you, had you had the songs written ahead of time or did you actually, you put the whole thing together that quickly?
No, that was, you know, those were my favorite songs from my 4 years of diligently writing pop music. So it, you know, I had a lot to choose from, and even a lot that went on the second album was from that crop, right. You know, some newer things, but that whole batch of songs from those 4 years really became the foundation of, you know, my style that people heard.
Is it weird to look back and have such a tangible reminder of that age? Not everyone can look back. You can look back at school papers to see what you're
right,
doing.
I know.
But you've got, like, you know, this is, guess, pouring your heart out at such a young age.
A glorified yearbook for sure. it's a great musical time capsule, really. You know, it's and when I say great, I mean it's great to have. It's such a slice of life at that time. You know, I think all those synthesizer sounds and all the puppy love diary entry type lyrics and, you know, you can hear direct influences from other artists at the time. I always joke that anytime a female singer does like, "Ah, boy, I'm wondering why," that's like borderline. I mean, that's Madonna. That's like she gave us that little cry, you know, so I was like being simultaneously influenced by what was on the radio while recording this stuff. So I think that's kind of a pretty interesting thing, because a lot of artists come out and they say, "Oh, I was influenced by the Rolling Stones 20 years ago, 30 years ago." This was like I was in direct contact with those influences and making that music in real time, and you can kind of hear all of that come. You could really hear that teenage music lover in me and all that youthful enthusiasm.
At the same time, though, the classic hooks to the songs, they stand up on their own.
They do.
Thank you.
It's a perfect pop album from beginning to end. Amazing.
Thank you. And it's a little piece of bubblegum candy.
It is. I mean, you just can't get any better. And to this day, me and Gary were just discussing, you know, before we came in here, 30 years later, I mean, you still hold a record, Gary.
Youngest female to write, produce, and perform Billboard Hot 100 number one, Foolish Beat.
Yeah, yep. I mean, and that song is timeless, is classic, and is brilliant.
Thank you.
Well, you've told me, Debbie, that's your that and Lost in Your Eyes are your two favorite songs of yours. But looking back at Out of the Blue, what else on the album stands out to you now as you look back and say, yeah, these are some of the really good ones on that first album?
Ooh, you know, I think for some, you know, it's funny, it changes all the time, like depending on the mood I'm in. So when you ask that question now, for some reason, Between the Lines popped into my mind as kind of a little, you know, a little gem that was obviously never released as a single. But I think a pretty solid song. I always loved Staying Together, which was fifth single. And obviously we all know fifth singles typically don't chart that well, but it's kind of I think a nice little bonus to throw out there to the fans, like, and you thought we were done, here's one more. But that song, I love the drive and the tempo, you know, I love the tempo. I love that. I think you could hear like almost a Motown influence in it. I opened my concerts with it on my first tour, so yep. I like that one a lot.
Is it true that you were, I heard this in another interview, you were signed to a single deal, and then If Only My Dreams did well, there'd be a second single, and then if that did well, there'd be an album, but Only My Dreams did so well that they moved up the time frame and said, yep, you've got the album.
Yes, you heard correctly. It went, if it charts well on the club charts, then we go to a radio single, and then we go to another club record, and then we go to another radio single. And yeah, so they were just like, quick, let's do the whole album and capitalize on the success of Only in My Dreams, which I'm so glad they did. And what's so funny is, like, when I think about it now, it's almost impossible milestones they were setting, you know, because you know how hard it is to have a top five club record, and you know how hard it is to have a top five radio single. So, you know, a pop single. So I think ignorance was bliss. Had I known that was a nearly impossible milestone to reach, that might have altered something. But I just kind of was like, well, someone's got to be at the top of the charts. Why can't it be me? You know, that's the youthful thing, that, you know, blind ambition. And it worked.
How did Out of the Blue become the title cut for the album?
You know, it just seemed like a no-brainer. That was definitely one of my favorite songs that I had written around that time. And it just felt, again, like I appeared from out of the blue. And it just seemed like such a fitting debut title. We toyed with the idea of just going with my name. And I always say to Tiffany, she's way cooler than me because she did that. But but I was always kind of a concept girl, you know. So I think I like having titles and images and costumes and things to play off of. So it felt like a fitting title.
And it was always kind of like iconic for the 80s album cover. What do you remember about the photo shoot?
Oh my goodness. Well, first of all, I hated that haircut. My team at the time and the label and everyone, they were like, you know, my hair looked, so when I first went to meet, like, there was an entertainment attorney involved and then there was a label, I had that straight blonde hair and bangs, like, you know, like you later knew me to have, like in the Lost in Your Eyes video. And everyone was like, well, you look really young, because at the time, young wasn't in. Young was scary. They didn't know how to market young. And they knew I was going to be playing clubs. So they're like, we need something edgier, something sexier, something that's less common looking. And so they went with that crazy layered haircut. And I had fun with it. I wasn't like, oh, my God, I hate this. The beauty, again, of being that young is you're like, it's hair. It'll grow out. Okay, this is fine. I'll try this for a minute. And so, you know, but I knew that it was something that wasn't, that hair wasn't totally me. So I do remember kind of being like, okay, this is trying something new on for size.
Right.
You know, and I also, like, I look at that and it's like, you can see I have like baby fat, even though the jeans kind of should like dig in at a certain place. And so when I look at it now, I just, think, oh my God, I was such a little girl. And I remember the teddy bear thing, and I just loved teddy bears. And the thing that stands out the most, though, is I remember the photographer saying, hey, there's so much skin on your knee and it's pulling focus from your face. And the makeup artist said, oh, I have an idea, very casually. I don't even remember her name. I worked with her that one and only time. She came over and she drew that face on my knee. And girls across the world showed up at my concerts with that face on their knee.
The other new thing, Debbie, that you have coming out October 20th, We Could Be Together. It's your first box set, 10 CDs, 3 DVDs, a coffee table book is part of it. How long was this? And I'm guessing this was more than 6 weeks, like out of the blue. This had to be a little bit more in the making.
This was like about a year in the making, even just my involvement. And even earlier with Demon Music kind of laying the groundwork and starting to put some pieces together to present to me. It's so funny because I was over in the UK last October and we were talking about releasing it potentially in February. And it seemed like we had all the time in the world. And as we started to move forward, I was like, oh my God, we need like a year. This is crazy. I mean, because, you know, because everything wasn't digitized back then, or really nothing was. A lot of stuff came from my storage units, came from DAT tapes that I had in my house, in my garage. Heather, my manager, was going through photos and slides and, you know, things in also in the storage unit and scanning things. And there were even a few items we call diehard fans for, like, do you have a digital copy, like a CD of this? Because we can't find it. Like, shout out to Ricky Morgan, one of my favorite dev heads. I was like, try Ricky. He's got more stuff than I even know I ever recorded. Because, you know, fans send me stuff to sign all the time. And I'm like, when was I on this compilation? Or, oh, I remember doing that now for that movie or that whatever. So it's been a wild thing putting this together. And one of the most, well, two of the most exciting things about it, one is that finally all the videos and the concert and everything are on DVD. Because for years, fans like, you know, tweet Atlantic Records and they're like, hey, can we get Debbie's VHSs on DVD already? So finally, yeah, we've, you know, stepped into this era. And then the other exciting thing is a lot of the music that was in my vault. And it's an interesting array of songs because it's not the songs that will represent what I do next. It's these songs that are like the bridgeway between where you last left off with me and what's to come. And those were the songs that wouldn't have had a home and would never have been heard, but this is such a great way to share them with the fans. And, you know, even demos, there was a duet I wrote with Howie D from Backstreet Boys that I ended up just doing really a glorified demo of, and we found it really, really in the 11th hour. I mean, I texted Howie and said, hey, remember that song we wrote, you know, years and years ago? Do you mind if I include it? Blah, blah, blah. And then within a day, he got back to me because I said, the deadline's tomorrow. I need to know. We're doing the artwork. And he was like, without any paperwork or lawyers or anything, was like, please put it on there. And so, and that's a song called The Last Word. And, but that was something that in the 11th hour I heard and I'm like, you know, this is just one of, again, this little gem that I'm probably never going to recut, but it was of a moment in time and it would be really fun to include on this project.
And I'm sure Debheads will know the title cut, We Could Be Together, but not one of your biggest hits. It was a Hot 100 hit. But how'd that become the title cut? Just the symbolism of being together with fans or favorite songs?
Yeah. I mean, a couple of things. First of all, that was one of my bigger hits in the UK. And so Demon really came up with this suggestion, and I did love it. I do feel like that song has that kind of sing along, everybody, with, you know, I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. It has that togetherness vibe, and that was always my concert closer, and I would bring the fans on stage for that song. So yeah, it really somehow feels like not the slickest title, but actually a personal, warm, welcoming title. And that picture they use, which is the back cover of the Electric Youth album, was always one of my favorite pictures because it's so me. That's me. That was like, that is not a stylist, you know. That is a really gorgeous shot, like lighting-wise and everything, of this fun, awkward teenage girl. I'm really glad they used it.
Isn't that weird how, like, you know, for Out of the Blue, you're saying, you know, I was stylized, people were kind of making my look, but then, you know, just a couple years later, you had completely taken on more of your own image, and, you know, it's such a small time frame, but, you know,
yeah,
what a growth
period. That's actually a really good observation, because I didn't even really think of it that way, but it's true. It's like, the Only in My Dreams video was probably the most styled I ever was, and then it got more organic from there. Yeah. I think people started trusting me more. You know, it's like by the third single or the fourth single, again, when we were looking at doing the second album, Doug and Amit were like, do what you did the last time. Like, they were like, we just, you know, want to keep the magic going. Yeah, the more they saw that my connection with the audience, the more they were trusting my instincts. And like an obvious comparison that I observe now is Taylor Swift, because I just look at her and think nobody's putting anything on her. Even the songs that she co-writes are her. They're her. They're quirky. They're connected. They're connected to her life. They're connected to her fans. What she wears, even if it's glamorous and stylish, you could tell it's an extension of her. And I just think that's the key to all of it. It's not about being the slickest vocalist, and it's not about having the cleverest, most craftiest songs. I think it's about that connection within yourself and to your audience. Like, to keep that going at all costs and at all times is like really the key.
And, you know, I always thought, I remember when We Could Be Together, it was on the Hot 100 here in the U.S. I remember it. So I was a chart fan at that point, a fan of yours. I remember it got to number 71 and being so upset that it didn't go higher. I always thought
I know. That was like my little baby. It was like, the little train that couldn't, unfortunately. Yeah. Like, I think I can. No, we can't. But okay. We tried. Right.
I always thought maybe it had been the second single, it might have done a lot better. But, you know, Electric Youth was after Lost in Your Eyes.
Right. I think you're right. I think it could have been, really, actually. That's another good observation. But, you know, again, it's such a fan favorite song that's where, you know, obviously I like kind of lived and died for those chart positions. I loved waiting for that call every week. But then I also started to realize that, like, in people's minds, Only in My Dreams was a number one pop song, but it really wasn't. But it's just that it was out there for so long, it felt like that. And Electric Youth felt like a number one to people, and it was like 11. So I think, you know, We Could Be Together had its moment somehow anyway. So I'm good with that. You know, one other random thing that just popped in my head from the box that's super fun, again, in the previously unreleased stuff, is that I worked on a couple of songs, but one in particular with a friend of mine, Fred Corey, who was a drummer for Cinderella. And again, I called him and I said, how do you feel about Pop Circus going on the box set? And he was like losing his mind because he loves that song. And I love, again, that what a surprise to have this rock drummer produce a really kind of Brit pop sounding, pretty slick little ditty, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah. So those are the things that kind of like rev me up about, you know, when these box sets arrive in people's homes, that they'll get to hear that stuff.
A lot of good things to look forward to.
Yes. And, you know, 750 Exciting. People who ordered on Amazon got a signed album cover flat. My arm is still recovering.
Oh, one of the things that, too, I read, Debbie, is there's a new interview with Fred Czar, who produced some of the songs on Out of the Blue and Electric Youth.
Yes.
Was that like a whole total going back in time, going back to when you guys had worked on those first couple albums?
Well, you know, I haven't read the interview yet. I actually came up with the suggestion fairly late in the game, and they love the idea. And I just thought, you know, no one's really ever heard from Fred. And I reconnected with him this past year. I had lost touch with him for a long time. And he's still the same old Fred. He's a great guy, and he's a brilliant producer. I mean, I feel like those songs, those like that Electric Youth intro, and just if you heard my demos and how they evolved from the demo to like when Fred put his polish on, keeping my pure intent, but making it sound so much better, and you know, just more sophisticated and punchier, and you know, he really is like an unsung hero. You know, he did the Papa Don't Preach intro for Madonna, the string intro, and I don't think he was ever credited for it. And that was one of his magical things he did. He did My Fallen Angel and Who Loves You Baby and all things that had almost a modern day classical feel. So I am really excited to read that interview. And you reminded me that I should just call up Demon and say, hey, can you please send me the interview? I've been so busy doing my interviews.
You'll have to wait. You'll have to wait for the box set to come out.
I'm going to have to wait until I have to order one on Amazon. Yeah. No, I would love to hear from his point of view what that whole adventure was like, because, you know, one minute he was working on some pretty good projects, but this was the biggest for him. And he and I together, I think, had a magic and created something new. And, you know, his basement studio, the vocal booth, was also his laundry room. I don't know if I ever told you that. But if I recall, there was like an orange sheet, and you pull the sheet back on a clothesline, and, you know, there were Fred's socks. So it goes to show you, like, you know, you don't need to be in the fancy, glamorous studios to make the magic. And in fact, I think the fact that it was so down home, and we didn't quite know what we were making and what we were doing, that's what came across.
Right. You're going to have to go back and listen for a whooshing of laundry in the background.
Completely, yes.
All right. So, Deb, yes. you mentioned stuff coming ahead and, you know, what is ahead for you? One thing I wanted to mention is you said your biggest hit on the Dance Club Songs chart, more than 25 years, featured on Sir Ivan's I Am Peace Man.
I can see the rain. I see the rainbows.
It's a never-ending party. The melody is so hypnotic. Everybody get excited. Colors of the rainbow. I see the rainbow. Oh, oh,
yeah. It's about loving life. It's about loving each other. So make some love tonight.
I don't know if you know this story, but so Sir Ivan is awesome. He's a very wealthy, charitable man who is very into social consciousness in records that he makes. And he walked into my first task on A Celebrity Apprentice, which was in a deli in Manhattan. And he said, I'll donate $5,000 to the charity if Debbie Gibson does a guest appearance on one of my records.
Yeah.
And I was like, make it 10 and you've got a deal. So he made it 10. And that was to the Wayutaya Foundation, Patricia Velasquez. And, you know, a couple of years went by, more than a couple of years. And he came to me with a couple of songs that didn't resonate with me yet. And I said to him, I know I agree to do this, but I want to make sure it's a really right fit. And then he came to me with I Am Peace Man. And I don't know if I mentioned, he walked in and they bedazzled cape with a big peace sign on it, by the way, that to that task. He's a larger than life character. And so this song just really resonated with me. You know, and he's donating a lot of the proceeds to like gun violence organizations, specifically in Chicago, where gun violence is at its worst, and to help people who have been through post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of violence in their communities. So, you know, he's a really cool guy. The song is really fun. There's a lot of homage to the LGBTQ community. Also about, you know, I Can See the Rainbow and, you know, the unfortunate events in Orlando. And so there's like some, you know, subtle nuances in the record that, kind of pay tribute to the lives lost in that event. So it's you know, and it's disguised as this amazingly produced by Ali D, by the way, who's awesome, you know, this festive dance song. But it's got a lot of heart, a lot of consciousness, and I had a blast being a part of it. Yeah, and all of a sudden I start seeing, you know, hey, you're charting, what? So again, it's like out of these really like unexpected situations can arise these nice surprises.
And musically, you're working on a couple Broadway musicals. One of them is Skirts, which I remember you were talking about way back in the day. I remember that title.
Yes. Yeah, so Skirts, we are trying to resurrect it again. And my collaborators are Hillary Carlip and Katie Ford. And trying to think what I can tell you, any new updates. Really, we just kind of round-robined recently to see how we could move it forward again, because I just think everything has a season, you know, not to start singing Corner of the Sky on you. Everything has its season, or maybe I will. But yeah, you know, I think everything has its moment, and that musical is really timeless. It takes place in 1964, the year of the World's Fair, and I think it's timely again, because it is about racial tensions, and you know, unfortunately that topic never goes out of style. I can't wait till it does. But the other musical I wrote with Jimmy Van Patten called, it's either going to be called The Flunky or Flunky Town. We keep going back and forth, and we're in a spot right now where we've got some great interest in producers and investors, and we're moving that forward as well. And that's kind of a dark comedy about people who go to LA and sell their souls to be around stardom, even if it's by association. So people that live in guest houses of rock stars and kind of leech on and forget who they are and what their own dreams were and get caught up. You know, I mean, I guess the parallel now also would just be reality television in general. Like, it's just the idea of these people that don't necessarily have a craft. Their craft is marketing themselves on television. And so it also, I think, is very poignant, and it's really fun, really, really fun.
That's great. And new music after the box set? Any plans for new songs, new album?
I feel like every time I see you, I'm like,
I always ask that.
It's coming. It's coming. And it still hasn't come yet. And there are some good reasons it hasn't come yet. There are two very big projects coming up that I am unfortunately sworn to secrecy on at the moment. You'll be hearing about them, though, I promise. So there's been a lot going into these other projects. And so the music, yet again, it'll find its little moment. And I know that when the moment comes, whether it's, you know, in a month or 6 months or whatever, I have a feeling it's going to be me going into the studio for like a month or two and bam, you know, it's just going to pour out because the songs are writing themselves as we speak. So, that's all to come.
Well, we'll have you back on. We'll keep asking you. How about that?
That would be super cool.
All right. Thank you so much, Debbie. As always, box set October 20th. And yes, we'll keep asking you about new music going forward.
Yes, thank you, as always.
It will happen, you guys. I promise. You'll be the first to know.
All right. Thank you so much.
Happy arrival day, Debbie.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Great to talk to you guys all again, and see you soon.
No. My dreams, as real as it may seem, it was only in my dreams.
The 2016 ballad version of Only in My Dreams, Debbie Gibson, here on the Billboard Sharpie podcast. Great chatting with her a second time on the podcast. She was on last year. Both times, Trevor. She's been on the day she was born. August 31st is when we did last year's podcast, and here she is again.
So August 31st. Can we expect next August 31st to check in with Debbie again?
Yeah, it's the present I give to myself every year.
There we go.
So great chatting with her and to Alex Vitoulis as well from the charts department. Hopefully that album, I'm going to keep asking, hopefully that album is coming along.
I mean, maybe, you know, sometimes it's a long wait. Sometimes you got to wait like a D'Angelo 14-year break, but sometimes it's that's always slow coming, but it arrives.
Yeah, and great that this box set is coming out. Fun to hear some of the stuff that's going to be on there, and talking about getting memorabilia from fans too, because some fans are just so devoted that they've got stuff that she didn't even remember.
Yeah, I love how excited she was about that, because I think that must be such a rewarding feeling as an artist to know that, you know. I mean, because, you know, these people probably have obviously gone to college, and they probably moved a couple times, and to know that they've, you know, kept up with these things that most people might just be like, you know, let me get rid of that era. Like, no, these are the ones who have stayed loyal all this time. That's got to feel so good, you know?
All right. So Debbie Gibson on the Billboard Sharpie podcast here on the Billboard Hot 100 this week, 1987, in the top five for the first time with Only My Dreams. And a week later, on the September 5th, a day to chart, she would debut on the Billboard 200 with Out of the Blue. That was the first hit of four top tens, five total singles that kicked it off for Debbie. So 30 years. All right. And now we'll move on. Numbers 4 through number 2 on the Hot 100.
My name is Luca. I live on the second floor. I live upstairs from you. Yes, I think you've seen me before. If you hear something late at night, some kind of trouble, some kind of fight, just don't ask me what it was. Just don't ask me what it was. Just don't ask me what it was.
Right, numbers 4 through 2 in the Billboard Hot 100 this week, 30 years ago. Number 4 is another person who was on the podcast last year, Suzanne Vega with Luca.
Tom's Diner.
Tom's Diner would come after Luca. This was her breakthrough hit, and she was actually here.
Did Britney Spears cover this song too, or no?
Not that I know.
Nah.
But Luca became a top 5 hit, got to number 3. It was down to number 4 this week. When Suzanne Vega was here last year, here's just a little clip of what she remembered about that song.
I thought of it as a Lou Reed song. I did not see it as any kind of single. The one who really saw its potential was my manager, Ron Feierstein. And he heard it, and he talked to me about it. And he said, I think that song can be a hit. Not just a single, but a hit. And I said, are you kidding? I said, no. And he goes, no, it's a song about an issue. And most songs these days are about, you know, nonsense. We need more songs about issues, about social issues. And I disagreed with him. I said, I don't think songs really change anything. And we had a very heated argument, which we did all the time. In the end, he was right. He produced that song. We worked on the production for 2 years to make it radio-worthy.
Yeah.
So anyone who says it's a fluke doesn't know all the work that went into that production. And I'm not kidding. I mean, the arrangement, the key that we put it in, the production, the mix. We played it on all these different systems, in a car, in a cassette tape, CD, you name it. You know, huge, beautiful hi-fi speakers. That song was worked to be a single, and it was. It ended up being what it was.
Yeah, you can hear that. That's cool to hear that, because it's to me the quintessential pop folk song. And I guess maybe that's why it's tough to get that kind of sound in other songs. You have to work 2 years on it, apparently.
On the one song, yeah. And that's the thing that both Tom's Diner and Luca have in common, is that someone, not always me, paid careful attention to the production and worked on it. So I don't know how long DNA worked on Tom's Diner, but somebody had a vision for that song. Probably Nick Batt did the actual remix, but Neil Slateford, I think, was the sort of marketing genius behind that duo. So I think he's the one who had the idea to put in the da-da-da-das as the riff,
right,
as the hook. And that, of course, was the genius of their version of it. So they worked that production. They thought about it, and they worked it. So neither of those songs were actually a fluke.
Suzanne Vega on the Billboard Chartbeat podcast from a year ago, she was on. Interesting, that song being a hit, it really was kind of an outlier for the time, because it's about a decade before Lilith Fair. And a year later, Tracy Chapman would hit the top 10 with Fast Car. But in the 80s, when music was so produced, to hear a song like Luca, which was produced too, but still very folk driven, in the top five, pretty rare. All right, number three, up to number three, its peak position, just like Debbie Gibson back at number five. Debut hit for Richard Marx, Up Don't Mean Nothing, starting a whole string of hits for Richard Marx as well. His first seven singles all hit the top five, including three number ones. Kind of fun lyrics in that song too. He's really just skewering the music industry, which kind of a bold move for a debut single, to kind of bite the hand that feeds you a little bit.
Well, that's interesting too, because I mean, I feel like nowadays in hindsight, yeah, you look at Richard Marx as kind of one of the smooth balladeers. You would think he would not, you know, not be a problem child, like at all, you know, in a sense. Like,
if you follow him on Twitter and socially, this really seems like the real Richard Marx. He likes to speak his mind. So, yes, he would be known for having these love songs, but
right,
he's pretty sarcastic, and he's fun. He has fun with that kind of stuff. And I remember even it was 1989, he went on a radio show. It was a live interview show with Adam Curry, who was the host from MTV, one of the VJs. And he just got into a fight with him on this live radio show. I remember hearing it at the time, thinking that this isn't scripted. And it was odd. For the next day, he just yelled at him the whole time. He said, you said something bad about me. You wouldn't say it to my face. And Adam Curry didn't know how to respond. And it just got really awkward. For the next hour, I think the other host basically did all the talking. But that's how he started the show.
Ooh, this is like Wendy Williams before Wendy, right, made it big.
Yeah.
Like, this is that trash talk confrontational radio. Wow.
It was fun. I still remember it now. It was that made that much of an impression back then. Still going really strong. Now he's become a writer for a lot of country hits. He's written number ones with and for Keith Urban. Wrote This I Promise You for NSYNC. That's where Richard Marx song.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's true. Also worked, I know, with Luther Vandross on one of his very last songs, Dance With My Father,
right,
which was released just really months before Luther would pass away in 2005. Actually won Song of the Year at the Grammys for that, so a nice sort of tribute for that as well. But good to see that he's still respected. And I know people also may have seen Richard in the news not too long ago, like around last December, when he was on an airplane and there's an unruly passenger, you know, seated near him, and he jumped right in. I mean,
right,
the guy was fighting the flight attendants, and, you know, just being really abrasive. And of all people, Richard Marx is right there, and, you know, he helps subdue the guy. And, I mean, it's great to see, like, on TMZ and everybody, and he was trending for a little while.
Right.
It was just kind of cool to be like, why is Richard Marx? Oh, okay, dope.
All right, so number three, Richard Marx's first hit. Number two, down from number one, weak at number one, four.
Who is that?
Who's that girl? Madonna. That's who that girl is.
Who else?
Her sixth of 12 Hot 100 number ones. One of her record, still to this day, 38 top tens. This point in 1987, she just couldn't miss at all. So no surprise that the song went to number one. And it's kind of interesting what is going to tie in to this song with what's number one and number two, because there is kind of a connection between the top two songs. Should we get to number one this week, 1987, Trevor?
All right, you sat patiently through this countdown for the past 2 weeks, waiting for this moment. Here we go, the number one, numero uno song on the Billboard Hot 100, August 29th, 1987. It is Look at Los Lobos.
Number one this week, 1987, La Bamba. So why are we saying it's connected to number two? So Spanish language song. Number one, and Who's That Girl has some Spanish in it for Madonna. She had done that earlier in the year with La Isla Bonita as well. So 30 years later, Despacito, it's all we've been talking about all summer. 30 years ago, Spanish language song. Number one. So before Despacito, before Macarena in 1996, those are the three songs that have gone to number one that have been all or mostly Spanish language.
Funny how it all comes together, you know?
And in the Billboard issue that week, 1987, Paul Grine, who we said started and wrote the Chartbeat column back then, noted how it gave songwriter Ritchie Valens his first number one hit, because he wrote the song. And his highest charting hit as an artist, Donna, peaked at number two in February 1959. That was 3 weeks after he died in the plane crash.
Yeah, and so we're talking almost 30 years after he passes away, you know, writing this number one hit. And how did it kind of come to be? People might be wondering, why would this have suddenly become popular 3 decades after he died as part of the crew in the infamous Day That Music Died? Well, actually, a Ritchie Valens movie had come out that same year, 1987, and really reignited the popularity of some of his tunes. And of course, his cover by Los Lobos got enough momentum behind it to take it all the way to the top.
Right, first of 3 weeks at number one, Come On, Let's Go, also from the movie La Bamba, starring Lou Diamond Phillips, would go on to hit number 21. So it was a moment in pop culture, and it's kind of similar to now. You've got all the acts you think would be on the charts. You know, Bieber, all the One Direction guys suddenly on the chart, but Latin music, Spanish language hit that comes along that's just so catchy can just overshadow everything. And just like Despacito now, La Bamba then, biggest song on the Hot 100.
You know, there's an audience out there that doesn't really get too much recognition from a lot of the mainstream in the U.S. But you know, when they find something that they like and something that is accessible, I mean, they support it, you know, in droves. And I think that's something that hopefully Despacito, that a lot more labels and artists and consumers are paying attention to.
All right, so there it is, the Billboard Hot 100 over 2 weeks here on the Billboard Choppy Podcast, number 40 to number one this week, 30 years ago, La Bamba, Los Lobos. And that is one of the reasons we did this countdown, is because Despacito being number one for so many weeks now on the Billboard Hot 100, just taking it back to a time when you can draw that parallel to when similar circumstances were happening 30 years ago. Those are some of the biggest Spanish language hits, and we already counted down 96, Macarena. So we've looked back at the songs that came before Despacito. All right, so that's this week's countdown. Great having Tiffany and Debbie Gibson on the last couple weeks. Next week, back to regular format, back to the current Hot 100. We've got the new Taylor Swift song on its way to number one on the Hot 100 next week.
Despacito now sitting at 16 weeks at number one, already tying the all-time record set by Mariah and Boyz II Men. Can Taylor stop Despacito, as I'm sure all the lambs, Gary perhaps included, would like to see?
All right, so back to 2017 next week here on the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. We still have, we got a whole chart here. We just did 40 through 1. We got other songs in the Hot 100. What's a good one to close with?
We got 60 options to pick from. Let's see. Okay, well, we finished off the Spanish triumvirate, so why not finish off the diva triumvirate? We had Madonna up there, we have Whitney. Let's bring in Janet Jackson. How about that? All right, Janet, coming off the huge year in 86 with her album Control, really putting her out there in the forefront as well as one of the next big R&B pop stars. We heard her actually last week on the countdown a little bit as backing vocals on the Herb Alpert song Making Love in the Rain, sitting at 39. And her own song, unfortunately, Gary, two spots below, just missing out on this countdown, the song The Pleasure Principle. Song had hit the top 15 already in its chart run. Not necessarily one of Janet's maybe best-known songs, but I guarantee you one of her best-known videos with her in the studio, dancing with a chair. That's been inspired. I mean, that inspired moves by Sierra, Aaliyah, plenty of others. So let's give Miss Jackson her due and close out. This is The Pleasure Principle. Oh, oh, oh.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.